we enter the last chapter in the Yoga of Divine Love. It was published on the 15th of November, 1918, and like all the other essays in this particular series, it was never revised nor returned to by Sri Aurobindo. So we have it now as he wrote it then. What might be of interest to you is that in the Arya, always the lead article was the Life Divine, so long as it was a series going forward. He did shift. Instead of placing synthesis of yoga second, had begun to place essays on the Gita there instead. In The Life Divine, in this issue, we find a new title, The Necessity of the Gnostic Being. What's interesting is that this chapter title is dropped when he comes to a revision. In 1939, 1940, as you remember, he recast The Life Divine. And some of the leading ideas in this chapter were rolled over into a general chapter called The Gnostic Being. But I thought you might enjoy hearing, because it is so resonant, what the opening lines speak in this this essay that later he would abandon. And any of us would find the writing of this essay one of the supreme moments of our openness to inspiration from above. He writes, "To express the power of the spirit in man is the highest aim of our living. It is on one side an evolution of that which our apparent being contains in potentiality within itself. On the other, a revelation of a real self which is always there within us, self-aware within, but not yet manifest to our outward self-awareness. It is at once a self-exceeding and a self-becoming or self-finding. From the evolutionary point of view, it is the growth of the human being to a divine supermanhood. For supermanhood means the exceeding of the very limited humanity which we now are. From the higher spiritual point of view, it is the divine from whom we proceed and in whom we secretly live, taking us up into union with its being and its nature, revealing himself to our consciousness in ourselves and the world and above, so that we shall grow into likeness with him and oneness with him and become in every way possible to man, spirit of his spirit, light of his light, power of his power, will of his will, mind of his mind, life of his life, substance of his substance. Life becomes flower and sap of the Godhead from the bulb of terrestrial nature and in the stalk of humanity." So see if this does not have assonance with which we'll study now. The mystery of love. The adoration of the impersonal divine would not be strictly a yoga of devotion according to the current interpretation. For in the current forms of yoga, it is supposed that the impersonal can only be sought for a complete unity in which God and our own person disappear, and there is none to adore or to be adored. Only the delight of the experience of oneness and infinity remains. So this is, of course, in tune with Advaita Vedanta, the disappearance of the drop into the ocean. And it is not, of course, the whole of Vedantic thinking, but it has become the preeminent school of Vedanta. And if the individual disappears into the transcendence, can you even say that an experience of oneness and infinity could remain? Because the individual once gone, what experience could there be? But he continues. But in truth, the miracles of spiritual consciousness are not to be subjected to so rigid a logic. When we first come to feel the presence of the infinite, as it is the finite personality in us which is touched by it, that may well answer to the touch and call with a sort of adoration. So even if we're pulled upwards to the impersonal, we are signaling somewhere in ourselves the nature of the attraction. That may be because we adore, we are attuned to, we want to give ourselves to a larger, a greater being. We want to aspire to that perfection. Secondly, we may regard the infinite not so much as the spiritual status of oneness and bliss, or that only as its mold and medium of being, but rather as the presence of the ineffable Godhead to our consciousness, and then too, love and adoration find their place. So again, this derives to an experience where we come into contact with the presence, the conscious force of a being. We feel that. We can't speak it. It's ineffable, from the Latin ineffabilis, what cannot be described, what cannot be spoken out. And when, pardon me, and even when our personality seems to disappear into unity with it, it may still be, and really is, the individual divine who is melting to the universal or the supreme by a union in which love and lover and loved are forgotten in a fusing experience of ecstasy, but are still there latent in the oneness and subconsciously persisting in it. So the oneness of the Supreme contains, even when unexpressed, the possibility of three terms of being: the transcendence, the universality, the cosmicity, and the form, the aspect of individuality. This fusing experience of ecstasy, again, is a culmination of what begins as an approach, moves into a contact, eventuates into a communion, and finally reaches union, identity. And Sri Aurobindo goes on to say, all union of the self by love must necessarily be of this nature. Love, lover, and loved, just like knowledge, knower, and the known. This is a merging of real aspects of a being whom we can best describe as Satchit Ananda. We may even say, in a sense, that it is to have this joy of union as the ultimate crown of all the varied experiences of spiritual relation between the individual soul and God, that the one became many in the universe. Because who is it that peeks out from individuality, looking back at the great source of all. It is the divine itself, himself, herself, hidden in every form. It is the only thing that is. This is the whole point of Vedanta. Yes, there is only one, whatever you call it. And however multitudinous and rich the world may be, there is still one being in which all of this floats and moves, dynamizes, shrinks, disappears, and reappears. Still, the more varied and most intimate experience of divine love cannot come by the pursuit of the impersonal infinite alone. For that, the Godhead we adore must become near and personal to us. Even if it is possible to have a profound love and attachment, an immersion of conscious being, the individual, into conscious being, the greater reality, still, let us come to the matter of the person with a capital P. It is possible for the impersonal to reveal within itself all the riches of personality when we get into its heart. And one who sought only to enter into or to embrace the infinite presence alone may discover in it things he had not dreamed of. The being of the divine has surprises for us which confound the ideas of the limiting intellect. So what is it that is beyond the beyond? When we have finished our ascent and seemingly disappeared into the vastness of abstract being, is there something beyond? It is that very thing that Krishna declares in the Bhagavad Gita as the Purushottama, that third status of being, the abstraction, the moving individual here, both are part and parcel of this greater reality, who is. Name that what you will. He, she, it is. But ordinarily, the way of devotion begins from the other end. It starts from, and it rises and widens to its issue by adoration of the divine personality. The divine is a being and not an abstract existence or a status of pure, timeless infinity. The original and universal existence is he, but that existence is inseparable from consciousness and bliss of being, and an existence conscious of its own being and its own bliss is what we may well call a divine infinite person, Purusha. So this is the Purushottama of the Gita. But let's remember, as we frequently do when we come to the term Satchit Ananda, existence, consciousness, bliss, it is a conscious existent whose nature is delight. And we first meet this term in theistic Vedanta, not in Advaita Vedanta, where it is seen as an appellation of a person who contains all the universe within itself, has a benevolent relationship with all the beings within the universe, despite the appearances of creation and destruction. That divine person looks with compassion and love and acceptance on all. All are part and parcel of its own being. Why would it stamp itself out of existence? Continuing the Sri Aurobindo here. Moreover, all consciousness implies power, shakti. Where there is infinite consciousness of being, there is infinite power of being, and by that power, all exists in the universe. In Sri Lalita Sahasranam, she is worshipped as one of a thousand names as Satchit Ananda Rupini. She who has this form of the conscious existent whose nature is delight. We could also go back to the Isha Upanishad here. The seventh verse, translated into English by Sri Aurobindo, reads more or less like this. He in whom it is the self-being that has become all existences that are becomings, sarvani bhutani, for he has the perfect knowledge. How shall he be deluded? Whence shall he have grief, who sees everywhere oneness, ekatvam? Seventh verse. You might also look at the Mundaka Upanishad, chapter 1, section 1, ninth verse, or the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, fourth chapter, the first verse, and again the 19th. All beings exist by this being. All things are the faces of God. All thought and action and feeling and love proceed from him and return to him. All their results have him for source and support and secret goal. It is to this Godhead, this being, that the bhakti of an integral yoga will be poured out and uplifted. So again, bhakti from the root bhaj, which means to attach to partake in, to have a portion of. And hence, when we come to the heart, bhakti is about love. But it is always about contact, communion, sharing real being. Transcendent, it will seek him in the ecstasy of an absolute union. Universal, it will seek him in infinite quality and every aspect and in all beings with the universal delight and love. Individual, it will enter into all human relations with him that love creates between person and person. So the richness in the imagination of the divine, inviting the human forward to share that divinity, will reveal more relationships than we can enumerate from what is human potential. But let us go a step at a time. He comes to us first as we are, and we go then from the near to the far. It may not be possible to seize from the beginning and all the complete integrality of that which the heart is seeking. In fact, it is only possible if the intelligence, the temperament, the emotional mind have already been developed into largeness and fineness by the trend of our previous living. That is what the experience of the normal life is meant to lead to by its widening culture of the intellect, the aesthetic and emotional mind, and of our parts too, of will and active experience. So life really is a school ground. We are preparing for something, but it's not to pass the grade, it's not to pass the test. It's to deliver ourselves into the nature of the divine by equipping ourselves, by developing the adhikara, which can permit that fire, that light, that bliss to descend into us unmixed. It widens and refines the normal being so that it may open easily to all the truth of that which was preparing it for the temple of its self-manifestation. Ordinarily, man is limited in all these parts of his being, and he can grasp at first only so much of the divine truth as has some large correspondence to his own nature and its past development and association. Therefore, God meets us first in different limited affirmations of his divine qualities and nature. He presents himself to the seeker as an absolute of the things he can understand and to which his will and heart can respond. He discloses some name and aspect of his Godhead. This is what is called in yoga the Ishta Devata, chosen deity, the name and form elected by our nature for its worship. In order that the human being may embrace this Godhead with every part of himself, it is represented with a form that answers to its aspects and qualities and which becomes the living body of God to the adorer. And note that this has direct application in the prospect of meditation. When one sits in meditation, often one has an image, the Ishta Devata, before one physically, and then closing the eyes, capable of manifesting the fullness of that image until it becomes alive and full of life, vibrant with felicity, with power, reaching out and pulling the sadhak towards it until oneness is achieved. These are those forms of Vishnu, Shiva, Krishna, Kali, Durga, Christ, Buddha, which the mind of man seizes on for adoration. Even the monotheist who worships a formless Godhead yet gives to him some form of quantity, some mental form or form of nature by which he envisages and approaches him. But to be able to see a living form, a mental body, as it were, of the divine, gives to the approach a greater closeness and sweetness. The way of the integral yoga of bhakti will be to universalize this conception of the deity, to personalize him intimately by a multiple and an all-embracing relation, to make him constantly present to all the being, and to devote, give up, surrender the whole being to him, so that he shall dwell near to us and in us, and we with him and in him. Manana and darshana, a constant thinking of him in all things and seeing of him always and everywhere, is essential to this way of devotion. You may remember that when Lele was briefly guiding Sri Aurobindo as he began his spiritual journey, Lele wanted to catch up with him and see if Sri Aurobindo had been practicing, had been meditating, and keeping regular hours of it. Sri Aurobindo responded in the negative because he never stopped meditating. He didn't have to sit for special hours. And this is what he means, to dwell constantly only on that. You speak with your neighbor. You write a letter. You send a check in the mail. Whatever it is you might be doing, your consciousness can be placed perennially, perpetually, unblinkingly on the only thing that really is. And all the rest is an attendant to that being, is a circumstantial shift allowing you to see that same divine reality in some other form, in some other aspect. You don't have to lose your focus if you concentrate on the one who is everywhere. When we look on the things of physical nature, in them we have to see the divine object of our love. When we look upon men and beings, we have to see Him in them and in our relation with them to see that we are entering into relations with forms of Him. When breaking beyond the limitation of the material world, we know or have relations with the beings of other planes, still the same thought and vision has to be made real to our minds. Shvetashvatara Upanishad, the fourth section, verses 10 and 11, if you want to read. The normal habit of our minds, which are open only to the material and apparent form in the ordinary mutilated relation and ignore the secret Godhead within, has to yield by an unceasing habit of all-embracing love and delight to this deeper and ampler comprehension and this greater relation. In all Godheads, we have to see this one God whom we worship with our heart and all our being. They are forms of His divinity. So, enlarging our spiritual embrace, we reach a point at which all is He, and the delight of this consciousness becomes to us our normal, uninterrupted way of looking at the world. That brings us the outward or objective universality of our union with Him. Isha Upanishad, verses 1 and 7. Inwardly, the image of the Beloved has to become visible to the eye within, dwelling in us as in His mansion, informing our hearts with the sweetness of His presence, presiding over all our activities of mind and life as the friend, master, and lover from the summit of our being, uniting us from above with Himself in the universe. A constant inner communion is the joy to be made close and permanent and unfailing. Shvetashvatara Upanishad, chapter 4, verse 17, chapter 5, verse 5. This communion is not to be confined to an exceptional nearness and adoration when we retire quite into ourselves, away from our normal preoccupations, nor is it to be sought by a putting away of our human activities. All our thoughts, impulses, feelings, actions have to be referred to Him for His sanction or disallowance. Or, if we cannot yet reach this point, to be offered to Him in our sacrifice of aspiration, so that He may more and more descend into us and be present in them all and pervade them with all His will and power, His light and knowledge, His love and delight. In the end, all our thoughts, feelings, impulses, actions will begin to proceed from Him and change into some divine seed and form of themselves. Bhagavad Gita. In our whole inner living, we shall have grown conscious of ourselves as a part of His being till between the existence of the divine whom we adore and our own lives, there is no longer any division. So too, in all happenings, we have come to see, we have to come to see the dealings with us of the Divine Lover and take such pleasure in them that even grief and suffering and physical pain become His gift thoughts and turn to delight and disappear finally into delight, slain by the sense of the divine contact, because the touch of his hands is the alchemist of miraculous transformation. Obviously, Taittiriya Upanishad, but also Shvetasvatara Upanishad, section 5, verse 6. Some reject life because it is tainted with grief and pain. But to the God lover, grief and pain become means of meeting with him, imprints of his pressure, and finally cease as soon as our union with his nature becomes too complete for these masks of the universal delight at all to conceal it. They change into the Ananda. You'll remember Sri Aurobindo's experience in the Alipur jail, where all became unmasked to his vision. He saw the warder, the judge, the prosecuting attorney, the defending attorney, fellow inmates, the walls, the trees, all as different figurations of Vasudeva, the divine. And he saw that this prison was a trysting ground in which, despite his apparent suffering and abjection, that he could meet secretly and even exclusively with this supreme being. When bitten by invading and marauding ants who covered his feet and legs, he made no objection, but having widened his consciousness to be one with the universal reality of Vasudeva, he felt each bite as a vibration of Ananda. And later he would write, the simplest of mantras, difficult to practice, turn all things to honey. So let me read to you an English translation from Sri Aurobindo from the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, chapter 5, verse 14. Shiva, the master of all becomings and not becomings, and from him this whole creation flows, and it is only one part of Shiva. But he is not named. After any nest of the winged spirit, and the heart alone can apprehend him. I think it's a good place to put our bookmark. We'll finish the chapter next week. But if you'll permit me, I'll read a little section from Savitri, Book 7, the Book of Yoga. This is in Canto 5, The Finding of the Soul. We'll begin on page 524. Across the threshold sleep she entered in and found herself amid great figures of gods, conscious in stone and living without breath, watching with fixed regard the soul of man, executive figures of the cosmic self, world symbols of immutable potency. On the walls, covered with significant shapes, looked at her the life scene of man and beast, and the high meaning of the life of gods, the power and necessity of these numberless worlds, and faces of beings and stretches of world space, spoke the succinct and inexhaustible hieratic message of the climbing planes. In their immensitude, signing infinity, they were the extension of the self of God and housed, impassively receiving all, his figures and his small and mighty acts and his passion and his birth and life and death and his return to immortality. To the abiding and eternal is their climb. To the pure existence everywhere the same, to the sheer consciousness and the absolute force and the unimaginable and formless bliss, to the mirth in time and the timeless mystery of the triune being who is all and one, and yet is no one but himself apart. There was no step of breathing men, no sound, only the living nearness of the soul. Yet all the worlds and God himself were there, for every symbol was a reality and brought the presence which had given it life. All this she saw and inly felt and knew, not by some thought of mind, but by the self. A light not born of sun or moon or fire, a light that dwelt within and saw within, shedding an intimate visibility, made secrecy more revealing than the word. Our sight and sense, our fallible gaze and touch, and only the spirit's vision is wholly true. As thus she passed in that mysterious place, through room and room, through door and rock-hewn door, she felt herself made one with all she saw, a sealed identity within her woke. She knew herself, the beloved of the supreme. These gods and goddesses were he and she. The mother was she of beauty and delight, the word in Brahma's vast creating clasp, the world puissance on almighty Shiva's lap, the master and the mother of all lives, watching the worlds their twin regard had made, and Krishna and Radha, forever entwined in bliss, the adorer and adored, self-lost and one. In the last chamber, on a golden seat, one sat whose shape no vision could define. Only one felt the world's unattainable fount, a power of which she was a straying force, an invisible beauty, goal of the world's desire, a sun of which all knowledge is a beam, a greatness without whom no life could be. Thence all departed into silent self, and all became formless and pure and bare. Then, through a tunnel dug in the last rock, she came out where there shone a deathless sun. A house was there, all made of flame and light, and crossing a wall of doorless living fire, there suddenly she met her secret soul. Namaste, Jai Ma. May you suddenly meet your secret soul.